What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golliver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael Pina of SB Nation. Michael, welcome to Zion Palooza. We are recording this on Thursday, not even 24 hours after Zion Williamson made his much-anticipated debut for the New Orleans Pelicans after basically missing 3 months following surgery to repair a meniscus tear in his right knee. Now, Zion did not completely shut the world down, but he had an incredible fourth quarter stretch that helped him finish with 22 points, 7 rebounds, and 3 assists. He did have 5 turnovers on 8 of 11 shooting in 18 minutes. The biggest surprise of all, of course, he went 4 for 4 from behind the 3-point line, and that almost like Jordan-esque shrug type performance, out of nowhere, brought down MVP chance from the Smoothie King Center in New Orleans. The home crowd just eating it up and realizing they finally got to see a flash of what they were all so excited about when they won the rights to the lottery, number one pick last year, and then obviously when they selected him in June. So, Michael, it was, I think, must-see TV. It was a very slow start from Zion, passive throughout really the first three quarters. He turned it on there in the fourth quarter with that electric stretch that I'm describing, but then they shut him down due to a minutes limit for crunch time, and the Pelicans wind up losing 121-117 to the San Antonio Spurs. So there are just layers upon layers upon layers to dissect here, and I'm going to start with the easiest question probably. What's your grade for Zion's debut? I need that letter grade from you, okay? You're the teacher. Bring out your red pen. What's your grade and why?
I'm giving him an A-. And
wow.
Yeah, is that too strict? Is that too lenient? What is the reaction there?
Well, I'm just, we're giving out A's for 3 minutes now, I guess. Is that what we're doing?
I started with a B and I kind of worked my way up throughout the day actually, but I'm going to start with the bad here. His first three quarters were objectively forgetful. I mean, there weren't any spectacular dunks. His first bucket was on a putback layup. He was fumbling around the court, turning the ball over, making really bad decisions on one play as the roll man. He caught a pass, and instead of, stopping and surveying the 4-on-3 situation, he tries to jump. He leaves his feet and tries to dump off the ball to Derek Favors, commits a charge when Alexander Walker was wide open in the corner. So there were just like rookie mistakes that are perfectly understandable, but nonetheless, he made them. So I have to mark him down for that, I guess. And just like the way he was moving throughout the game, I don't know if this looked the way it did on TV as it did in person, but he was just like trotting up and down the court. Like there was no dead sprint. Like maybe I think he might have broken into a dead sprint maybe once or twice in the entire game, which was a little disappointing. There wasn't the type of explosiveness and athleticism that I personally expected. But then, we get into the fourth quarter and incredible. Like the going 4 for 4 from behind the 3-point line. In our last episode, I said that him being willing to shoot outside shots was kind of a big question mark for me, and in what setting and in what format he would do it. And, the Spurs basically begged him to shoot those threes. They were in a zone for most of them. The Pelicans were playing him at the five, and he had a big on him and he was letting them fly. And that was awesome to see, the fact that they went in and he was shooting them with confidence. I also want to quickly say, in the first few stints that he had, I noticed that like the Spurs were treating him like a megastar already. Like he had one post up where he had LaMarcus Aldridge on him, and Patty Mills dug to help off of Josh Hart like Zion was 1994 Hakeem Olajuwon. Like it was just kind of bizarre to see, instead of just letting him play straight up. And Pop, there's these things that I like to call Steph stoppages, which are timeouts that Greg Popovich calls when he wants to prevent an opponent from getting into a rhythm or stopping the crowd from frothing at the mouth. And Pop used those timeouts, like the Steph stoppages, for lack of a better phrase, because he uses them against Steph Curry. When Steph Curry gets hot, you know, the first assist that Zion had, he called timeout. And then there was this other play where Zion caught a rebound and pushed in the open floor and found, I believe, Etuan Moore for a layup. Pop called a timeout. So it was like a superstar treatment, and which was kind of bizarre. But the respect level was there. They clearly feared him. They clearly respected him. And I'm going with an A-.
Well, first of all, you said for lack of a better phrase, Michael, there is no better phrase. That's a great phrase, Steph stoppages. I love it. There's alliteration. It's a, you know, it's a very accurate and obvious and easy to understand nickname. I might be stealing that one. You should be very proud of your coining ability there. I wonder if some of the extra attention that you're describing, especially early, was partially respect, but partially an idea of forcing turnovers, of, you know, getting him to make bad decisions. He did have 5 turnovers on the night. A couple of them were very sloppy. And to me, he looked fatigued. He was dragging the leg, like I think you were describing. But also during even pregame warmups and at the beginning of the quarters, you know, he was tugging on the shorts, you know, hands on his waist pretty regularly. And, you know, that's natural. I mean, after being off that long, the Pelicans do want to kind of push the pace and try to get things going. He didn't really seem to me like he settled into the rhythm or really, you know, found his pace until that fourth quarter, because in part because of the minutes limit. I mean, he was only playing 4-minute stints. It's really, really hard to kind of get up to speed and feel like you're in the game in a 4-minute time period, and then you're just immediately being pulled off the court. So that's going to annoy him, I'm sure. And we did hear a little bit of annoyance from him in his post-game comments about how he wanted to close the game. But I also just think, like, the way those rotations are staggering, it's just going to bother him because, you know, as soon as you're actually kind of catching your wind, now it's time to go back to the bench. In terms of them daring him to shoot, I love that they just stuck to it, right? Like, Popovich will go down with the ship sometimes, you know, when it comes to his strategies. It's like, if the book says let him shoot, it doesn't matter if he hits 5 in a row, fine, we're just going to let him do it. And I really do think that if he had stayed in the game and stayed hot, like, there just would have been no adjustment, and he probably would have shot them to a victory in that game, which would have been, you know, maybe even a more remarkable story than, you know, what did transpire before he was shut down late. In terms of my grade, it is a tricky one because, you know, that 3-minute stretch to me, that's like A++, right? I mean, that's arguably the most electrifying 3 minutes of the entire NBA season. I mean, other than some Lakers, Clippers, you know, tense late game moments, I think that's kind of the best basketball environment in terms of just sheer fun that I've been to this season. And I've been going to a lot of games. So that's like, I'm not trying to, you know, say that, you know, not trying to diminish anything else. I just think that's how fun it was. I mean, the crowd really, really got into it, super loud, and his teammates were there for him. I mean, it was just kind of like a storybook moment there in the fourth quarter. But at the same time, I don't want to discount the early struggles, because some of those turnovers, I do think that they were fatigue-induced, but they were pretty rough. His impact on the glass was a little bit slower to start. Obviously, he bodied Jakob Poeltl on that, you know, one famous defensive rebound everybody's been talking about. It was like a posterization of a rebound, yeah, which you don't see very often. He had the nice finish in traffic, too. But again, he was struggling with some of the length of defending him in the paint, which I think is going to be a recurring problem for him. And then he had moments where he's blowing by guys and showing that burst, but not anywhere near to the degree of what we saw in preseason, where he was just like basically irrepressible, like you couldn't hold him back. So I probably lean more towards a B+. I mean, maybe I would have gone a little higher if they had won the game, but that's not necessarily his fault because he was sitting and watching. But all things considered, I think it might be a more memorable debut than like a pristine, huge impact, huge numbers type of debut.
Yeah, I think that that's all fair. I mean, contextually, it being the first start of his career, the attention that he had was, I mean, this was like I don't know what the ratings are or what there will be, but I would imagine that this was one of the more highly viewed regular season games in recent memory. I mean, the focus all day long was on Zion Williamson and what he was going to do in his first game. So all that attention and all that pressure, I kind of added that into why I gave him an A-, because the, you know, he's struggling for the first three quarters. He's a little bit fatigued, as we've mentioned, and then he comes out and he hits those four threes despite the defense basically daring him to shoot. So that's just why I had to edge higher than a B plus. So that was just very impressive to me.
No, on the fun factor, it was an A plus. I mean, I don't worry so much about like the sustainability throughout a game if we're just talking sheer fun. I did hear one person from ESPN say that they were treating the game as if it was somewhere between the impeachment hearings and the moon landing, which I thought was a good line, and also accurate, because all day long it was just Zion highlights on loop on ESPN. You know, we were there at the practice facility for shoot around on Wednesday morning, and like they obviously have the TVs tuned to ESPN in the building, and it's just like Zion, 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 Zion. You go out onto the court, and there he is, and you know, certainly he realized he was the center of attention. My second question for you, Michael, and I've got seven of these. My second question for you is, what was your real-time reaction during that fourth quarter three-minute outburst specifically? Because I was kind of in shock. I was reeling from the slow start to the game. I was getting dozens of people blaming me for jinxing Zion because I was there. And like every time I go to the game, something bad happens for him. So I was taking it very personally. And I was like concocting, like, who am I going to blame this on to like kind of shield Zion from the criticism and like the bus talk that I was worried was going to be coming today after he started so slowly. And then that fourth quarter, my eyes just lit up. I mean, I could barely even operate my phone to take like in arena videos. I was transfixed. I mean, maybe brainwashed would be a better word in terms of, you know, just my relationship to that moment of just, you know, kind of losing mental control. And it was overwhelming, I'll be honest. What were you doing during that fourth quarter outburst? How were you responding?
Ben, I have a confession. Are you ready for this? One of the all-time great regrets of my life.
Oh, no. You went to bed early, didn't you?
I fell asleep at halftime, and I am still, I can't even, like, I debated even admitting this to you and saying it publicly, but whatever. Yeah, I fell asleep.
No, you're off the hook. You're an East Coast guy. You wake up at like 6 o'clock in the morning. I mean, you're practically like one of these people who does like 2 hours on the treadmill before sunrise. You know, you're one of those like crazy type A guys who gets all his work done before like 10 a.m.
Yeah.
So I'm going to let you off the hook for that. So, but this makes it even better, Michael. How bad did you feel about yourself when you woke up this morning and watched the fourth quarter?
So I get this email from you, and it has these seven questions, and one of them is, you know, what was your real-time reaction to his fourth quarter outburst? And I was just like, you just got to be kidding me. Like, I read that sentence seven times and then wanted to just go back to bed for the rest of my life. So that was devastating. I after the, you know, the 2 hours on the treadmill, as you mentioned, I went and I sat down, I poured myself a cup of coffee, and I queued up the DVR, and I knew that it was something magical that happened. I did not know, I was able to hide myself from who actually won the game and what exactly he did. So I did not know about the four threes. I did not know that he was benched at the end. I did not know any of that. So I still went in blind, relatively speaking, but I had a hint that something awesome was going to happen. So when I did actually get to watch it, I still was like by the third three, I was expecting that to miss. The fourth three, I expected that to miss. Like, I didn't, it was still surreal to actually watch, even though I knew something was big was going on in the moment. And then, you know, looking at the box score after, it's just like 22 points in like, how did this dude do after watching the first half when he was just like waltzing around the court, trotting up and down, like for him to do that in the second half, that's basically why I had to adjust from the B to the A minus.
I'm glad you asked that question. How did he do this? I think for all the basketball coaches out there, all the basketball players out there that listen to this, it's an incredible teachable moment. So many players in this situation understandably would have not like mentally checked out, but would have resigned themselves to it not being their night after the first three quarters, right? Saying, look, I just don't have it. I'm working my way back. It's, you know, uncomfortable. I've got these short stints. I mean, the excuses would easily be able to build up. There was also some positive moments early. So you could say, oh, well, I didn't shoot that well. I didn't score that much, but at least I had a couple nice passes. Like, the rationalization process easily could have kicked in for Zion Williamson. Instead, it went the other way. And that's what I mean by a teachable moment. You want to talk about a guy playing through incredible scrutiny, incredible attention, dozens of people there who aren't normally there from the media standpoint, a very expectant crowd, teammates who are sort of trying to feel him out and see what he's all about. The weight of, you know, the ESPN, you know, industrial complex, all, you know, around him, just kind of almost consuming him constantly. And his response to those circumstances were to, you know, to step up, to take responsibility, to take the shots that were given to him, to play the right way, to continue playing hard, to not give up, and then to want to, you know, to go to his coach and say, let me, you know, screw my minute limit. I want to keep playing. That is an awesome mental response. And it's something I've said about Zion for the last couple of years, really. The physical tools are great. The mental makeup, the competitiveness, the charisma, the moxie, that stuff is also great. And if he is going to hit in the ways that we think he's going to hit, it's going to be a combination of both. Casual fans will always be able to see the physical tools. The more you watch him, the more you see how he plays for his teammates, the more you see his work ethic and level of commitment, I think you're going to see that mental stuff come through more and more. And I think that's part of what has really drawn me to him as a prospect and as a player. And it was just really cool to see him just step up in that moment and own it. And the building like could not have been more appreciative. So on that note, Michael, that brings us to my third question, because what a test for the minutes limit idea, right? I mean, here he is going nuts, can't miss a shot. You're flabbergasted that he's not missing these threes. And yet down the stretch, because he's reached his 18 minutes, the Pelicans decide to stick to it, leave him on the bench, go without him into crunch time, and they wind up losing a game that's very important for playoff positioning. And it's a game you could absolutely argue, had Zion closed it out, he could have helped them win, right? If you were Alvin Gentry, knowing the importance of that game, knowing all of the pressure of everybody wanting Zion to play both inside the building and outside the building, would you have stuck to the minutes limit, or would you have just said, you know what, the last 2:30 or the last 4 minutes, whatever, Zion can handle this. Let's get him back in there, and we can worry about whatever fallout there is from our bosses or the medical staff in the morning. Let's just go for it. Let's roll the dice. Like, what would your decision-making process have been like?
As someone who is a total coward when it comes to displeasing commands, I would have done what Alvin Gentry did. I mean, there were comments made after the game by David Griffin on Adrian Wojnarowski's podcast. I'll paraphrase. He basically said that the coaching staff was not comfortable with the four short bursts, and then he's out at the first sign of fatigue mandate. But, quote, I don't really care. So it was kind of, I could imagine the conversations that were being had, like, in preparation for this game, where you know, maybe a hypothetical scenario is drawn out where, you know, if we're close, like, can we squeeze this out of Zion, blah blah blah. And it didn't seem like that was it wouldn't even matter. I mean, this was like the all-time scenario where you would ride a player through a minutes restriction. It was an important basketball game midway through the season. They want to make the playoffs, and he was playing great. I mean, I will also say, like, defensively, they were going right at Zion in the pick and roll and getting whatever they wanted. So there's really no guarantee that they would have won the game had they played him. And if you lose that game and you play Zion as long as you did and disobey your orders, like, it's just, at the end of the day, if I'm Alvin Gentry, I would rather coach Zion for the next 10 years than get the win over the San Antonio Spurs.
Well, it's nice to know that you're a coward when it comes to commands. I feel like I can use this to my advantage, maybe, here as we go forward on this show. I'll have to work on that, you know, give you more direct orders. but I think your ultimate conclusion here, that they handled it properly, that there were some very real risks to the alternatives, is right. I think that they, you know, I'm going to co-sign with their plan. Like, I'm sure they've put an unbelievable amount of time, effort, and thought into it, way more than any commentator could ever put into it from the outside. If that's the plan, stick to it. And I think that was my takeaway. I was impressed by their restraint, right? Sticking to such a deflating plan in that particular moment when you've got to sell season tickets. You know, there was empty seats in the building last night. You've got to appeal to a fan base that's, you know, puts teams like the Saints and LSU football on a higher pedestal than the Pelicans. Like, you have real business interests, not to mention, you know, there's going to be more attention on your franchise during that game than at any point unless they make the playoffs this year, you know, down the stretch of this season. Like, this is sort of your coming out party to the world. And to have the discipline to sit him down, it just impressed me, you know. And there are a lot of front offices that I believe would have gone the other direction with it, potentially, you know, putting their player in a less than ideal situation. And I just kind of tip my hat to them. Like, if that was your plan and you were really able to stick to it, you passed the test. So good job. But I do want to flip this around the other way, Michael. Imagine you're a Pelicans fan, right? And you've been waiting for this day since the draft lottery, and you have to sit through the Anthony Davis trade request and then the trade, and now you get Zion, but you have to wait 3 months. He looks great in the preseason, but you know, you never really get your full taste of it during the season. He goes out and puts up 17 points in a consecutive points in the fourth quarter. It's the greatest day of your life if you're a diehard Pelicans fan, right? I mean, for your basketball life anyways. Maybe you have a wife and children or a husband and children, and there's other, you know, moments along the way that could be higher points than, you know, Zion's coming out party. But arguably not, depending on the quality of your children. How would you have reacted? Would you have done what they did, which was sort of cheer, we want Zion? Would you have booed, like the coaching staff, try to shame them into playing him? What's your reaction in the building once you realize he's not coming back in the game?
I mean, I'm super duper pumped that this guy is on my favorite basketball team. That's probably my reaction even after watching them lose. Like, don't be short-sighted with it. Take the long view. He's super young. What he did is just the beginning of, you know, an extremely special adventure that we will all go on together. So, like, I wouldn't overreact personally if I was a fan of the Pelicans. I want to just real quickly go back to the last question, though, and talk about the minutes limit. And one concern that I have with it is, like, how long is this going to last with the bursts and the short stints? Because I have a fear, like, I don't want to go on too long of a diatribe here, but I have a fear of another team doing basically what the Bucks do with Giannis in the shorter stints that they play him on, to basically preserve him and let him maximize in those shorter stints as opposed to playing normal minutes like other superstars. Like, I really hope the Pelicans aren't too careful here and too cautious, knowing that he is such a unique body and such a, like, physically preposterous person that they're not so sure how to deploy him. So that's like that's one concern that I have real quick. I don't know what
you're saying is, like, if Milwaukee is playing Giannis only 30 minutes a night, which is obviously denying us like crazy stats and production from him, but, you know, for the greater good, you're worried that maybe New Orleans takes this to the next degree and we get down to like Zion averaging 24 minutes a night and we're all sitting around saying, like, wait a minute, like, what are we doing here? Like, we understand you're being cautious, but, like, could we just have a little fun? Like, can we watch this guy? That's what you're worried about?
Basically, yeah. I mean, they touched on it a little bit on the broadcast about, you know, if you play a guy for 4 minute stints, like, he has no opportunity to get his legs under him. He has no opportunity to catch a rhythm. I think Zion,
that's 100% true. Yeah. And you could see it. I mean, you could see it out there. But the flip side of the argument was, he couldn't even make it 4 minutes at the start of the third quarter. I mean, ugly turnovers very quickly. That looked like fatigue-induced turnovers, and he looked tired. He was grabbing his shorts. He was grabbing his waist. So, to me, I was okay with it for now. I share your concern, okay, how long does this last? But I also feel like it's fairly easy to ramp up. If he can handle 4 and he's not showing fatigue, then you push him to 5, then you push him to 6, and hopefully you eventually get to 8 or something like that. But, you know, I think it could take all of the rest of the regular season to get him into a normal rotation. You know, I guess that's my expectation. That's not reported, but I just didn't think he looked that great from a physical standpoint. He was dragging his leg a little bit. He clearly was tired. We didn't get a lot of explosive vertical movements from him. You know, there was a couple, but that was about it. So I just think he's got a ways to go.
Yeah, and I mean, one last thing, like, when you play short stints like that, it disrupts the rhythm of everybody else, too, and guys coming in and out of the lineup and different units that haven't played as many minutes. So it's going to be really interesting how they integrate him over the next few weeks as they also try to make the playoffs. Like, you're not just throwing him into the pool and letting him play 34, 35 minutes a night. It's this weird, the stints are just, it's just very strange. So I'm very interested to see how it plays out over the next few weeks.
Yeah, the guy I feel a lot of empathy towards is Brandon Ingram. You know, right at this moment where he's hitting kind of all-star level production, getting comfortable. It's been a couple years in the making, never really found it in LA. He now has to basically defer to a degree to Zion's return, and then, like you're mentioning, probably have his own rotation or at least his responsibilities adjust in a fairly major way to accommodate Zion. That's tricky, and it's especially tricky for guys who are in rhythm, and now you're disrupting it. So it's for sure something to track, and it's part of the reason why I was a little bit dubious of the computer model saying that they were like the odds-on favorite to make the 8th seed in the playoffs. I mean, I think these are some real things they've got to work through on the fly. It would be spectacular if we get LeBron versus Zion in that first round, but I'm not taking it for granted. I'm not penciling that in quite yet. There's a lot of other good teams competing there, and most of those teams have figured out who they are, and the Pelicans obviously are kind of approaching this almost from an October mentality when it comes to getting Zion back into the swing of things. So I just touched on this fifth question that I had for you briefly, but how did you think he looked just strictly from a health perspective? Like, I guess, percentage-wise, what did you think? And then when do you expect him back towards, like, 100%? Like, are we going to see that this year or no?
I hope we see it this year. I mean, it definitely wasn't there last night. You could just tell. We've talked about it throughout this whole pod, just how he was moving up and down the floor. It was just he was really conservative, I feel like, with his body, which is understandable. And the Pelicans training staff obviously saw signs of fatigue that influenced subbing him out of the game when they did and when they chose to. He claims that he was not gassed before the fourth quarter, which I don't necessarily believe, but
yeah, we've got the footage on that one.
Yeah, but there were the moments, like the rebound over Poeltl was like jaw dropping athleticism. I don't know how many guys in the league can make that play. And he had a drive in from the corner where he spun around Aldridge just like lightning quick, where he just defies physics with his body. So it's like, if this isn't 100%, then when he gets to 100%, he'll be even more must-watch television. And so I hope we get there, within the next few weeks, maybe right after the All-Star break. That would be nice. He can rest up. That would be great.
I think I'm more conservative on this one. I'm not sure we're going to see it till next year. Part of it could just be me betting against my heart, but I'm looking at this as maybe a longer-term thing. Some of it is just like relearning how you move. I've had that meniscus surgery. It does. I mean, it's just a weird one. It's not like the biggest deal in the world, but it does take a while to kind of readjust mentally. He had told reporters on Tuesday how frustrated he was at times during his, rehab process, like wanting to kick chairs and stuff because he was getting impatient and it was just trying to get through it. And, you get back on the court and you feel like, okay, that's the finish line. But, as we know, that's not really the finish line. That's just kind of the halfway point to full recovery. Two final quick questions for you here, Michael. And this is, kind of a leading question from me, but can you believe that there was hundreds and actually probably more than 1,000 empty seats in the building, the Smoothie King Center, for Zion Williamson's NBA debut? Can you believe that?
Yes. I mean, based on everything we know about the general indifference that city has towards NBA basketball, I was looking at some of the attendance numbers throughout Anthony Davis's career. The highest that they climbed was 21st. They were 29th during his rookie season. And, the hype for AD probably wasn't at the level that it is for Zion for a variety of reasons, including just like the day and age that we live in. But AD, I mean, he was coming off obviously winning the national championship, playing with Team USA for a stint. Like, he was as sure a thing as a number one pick as you can get, and he's super exciting as well. So it doesn't really surprise me. It's disappointing for sure, and I hope that they eventually become like a sellout, a nightly sellout arena, but it just doesn't shock me at all.
Maybe I should have been less shocked than I was. I was shocked. This guy is a national basketball phenomenon. Biggest story in sports yesterday across the globe, really, from a basketball standpoint. He sells out Las Vegas Summer League for a scrimmage in a matter of minutes, and the scalpers are getting in on the secondary market, you know, ticket market, you know, boosting the prices up, you know, 300% over face value and all this. That's what I expected. I expected this to be something where, like, people were coming from far and wide to take in the Zion debut. You know, you could tell all your friends for the next decade that you were at his first game. The Pelicans gave everybody a week's notice. There's not anything else going on in the city right now. I mean, football's over. You know, games on national TV, which helps kind of promote it a little bit. The arena's is big. I'll give them that. But, you know, the excuse people tend to make, it's like, okay, football, it's, you know, only 8 home games versus, you know, basketball, it's like 41 games. And I understand that. It is hard to sell season tickets, you know, to get that kind of an obligation or that kind of investment from your fans. But Zion's only going to debut once. Like, if there was one game you were going to go to all year long, or your entire life, really, or if you just wanted to come in and experience the show, you're a casual fan or not even a fan, this was the moment to do it, right? Like, compare it to a concert or any other event that might be coming to town. Like, this is it. How are there empty seats? On StubHub, they were going for $9, and they still were empty. Like, I hate to be the person, and look, I try to be a good house guest, Michael. I'm not going to go over to your living room and insult your wife's vase. You know what I mean? It's just like, what is that whack vase? Why do you guys have that there? Or like the art on your wall or whatever else. I hate doing that. I don't want to be that person. Obviously, we fly in, you know, from, you know, different communities that might value basketball differently compared to, you know, football or whatever else. So I understand there's cultural things at play, but there is no excuse for there to be empty seats to Zion. It, to me, it's just like a philosophical thing. Like, do I just like basketball too much? Am I in too deep here, Michael? It just, for the life of me, there should not have been a single empty seat last night.
No, I mean, you don't like basketball too much. Nobody who likes basketball does like it too much. It's great, but I think that once you take it to the road, once they hit the road, and once Zion is playing away from New Orleans, it's going to be a different type of atmosphere for sure.
And that's brutal, because he's a national phenomenon, but not a local phenomenon. You should all, okay, look, you should draw on the road. No question. That's great. You know, it's like the world tour that the Warriors used to go on, right? Where mm-hmm. it was like the biggest deal in the world where Steph shows up. There's going to be markets that are just going to go crazy for Zion. And I can't wait to see that night to night. But it's your home base. Like, you know, the people who were there were so excited. They were so in. And I feel like every person who attended that game, you are now like a multi-level marketer, right? You are now the word of mouth person. You need to go tell every person that you know that they need to get in on this thing at the ground floor. Like, everybody needs to go to this game, because first of all, the people who were there, I can't imagine they've had more fun than that fourth quarter stretch at basically any point of their lives, right? That's how awesome it was. So, I don't know. They just, you know, the recruitment effort of Pelicans fans just needs to increase.
Ben, if you weren't there last night, though, and you live in New Orleans and you're vaguely a basketball fan, like, what is it going to take to get you? Like, it's, I don't really know what.
No, I would not describe myself. Look, bottom line, I'm calling everyone out. If I lived in New Orleans and I considered myself a basketball fan, I would have been at that game, period. There is no scenario where I would have been able to live with myself and consider myself a basketball fan and not be in that building, right? The arena's convenient. There's parking. It's $9. It's like 3 hours of your life. You know, I don't care if it's your anniversary. I don't care if it's some holiday that you celebrate. I do not care. You need to be in the building for that. And like I said, I mean, I don't expect that every single night because attendance numbers really rely heavily on that season ticket base, right? I mean, there's no doubt. And so expecting that to just flip immediately. But after we heard the hype about New Orleans embracing him, how many jerseys he sold in the first 24 hours, how many season ticket packages that they sold, and everything else. I mean, it's been a, you know, a struggling franchise from the box office side for a while. But I just it blows my brain up. My brain cannot comprehend that there was anyone in New Orleans that had $9 to their name that was not in the building.
Ben, I got to say, I'm honestly surprised you have not started to blame DeMar DeRozan and Greg Popovich and LaMarcus Aldridge for this yet.
I'm not going to go there. Look, I mean, I'm going to see the game tomorrow night against Denver, and it'll probably be a smaller crowd, right? Because it's not the first night, and they're probably not as big of a draw either. But I just hope that the buzz starts. You know, catch the Zion fever. It's a good place to be. My last question for you is simple. What's the legacy from this game, Michael? Are we going to talk about Zion's debut like some people still talk about LeBron's debut? Are we going to remember the minutes limit part of it? Are we just going to focus on those four threes and just how wild it was? Like, are we all going to be sitting here saying, man, like, he made four threes in his first game and he hasn't made four threes since, like, 2 years from now? What is the lasting takeaway or the legacy of this game? What do you think?
When I'm telling my grandchildren about this game, I'm definitely saying that I stayed up until the very last buzzer. I was there. I never wavered. I didn't blink through the whole thing. I had faith. I don't really even remember LeBron's debut. So I hope that, you know, maybe I'm too young. Like, I don't even recall watching it, to be honest. But, like, off the top of my head, I know that it was against the Sacramento Kings. But I had to look up his box score from that night. And, 25 points, 9 assists, 60% shooting from the floor, pretty decent. But I don't have any, like, visceral memories from it or any. Like, they don't really play replays of it either. So I would hope that this is a little bit more memorable. It was a little bit more dramatic for sure. Just like the fourth quarter, those four threes, those will stick with me definitely. But I also think that he'll have the type of career that will completely overshadow what he did last night.
Yeah, I'm with you. I mean, the LeBron thing is just kind of lived on because of social media. People love to do the throwback. Oh, hey, here's highlights from his first game. We knew he would be a star, right? I can see the same thing happening for Zion, mostly because that, 17-point stretch is just so clippable. You know what I mean? You just, like, line those highlights up, and he's the highlight king. And, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, you just say, hey, remember when Zion had 17 points in 3 minutes in his very first NBA game? And I think the whole rest of it, the minutes limit stuff, the loss, all of it's just going to kind of fade to the background, and people are going to kind of cherish that stretch and the huge crowd reaction. I think that's really what we're going to remember. All right, Michael. Now, we were going to talk about this earlier this week, but we just didn't get a chance to do it, so we're running it back here. And guys, don't forget, email us, openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. We will take your questions and really address them next week. It's kind of an interesting episode here with the Zion game, so we're not going to do questions from the audience today, but please send them in, and we are still going to debate All-Stars and all that stuff as soon as we get the coaches' picks and everything else coming out here over the next couple days. Now, Michael, I mentioned it was a pretty interesting stretch of games. You go all the way back to last Thursday when the Bucks played the Celtics. Then the Bucks went to New York City to personally play in front of you. Meanwhile, I was down in Texas watching the Luka and the Mavericks have a nice shootout with the Blazers. And then I also saw the Lakers just kind of dismantle the Rockets. On top of that, we had the Celtics turn around and dismantle the Lakers. There's just a lot going on all the way around, involving contenders. I think my first question for you, though, do you agree with me that the narratives about the Bucks need to shift? I wrote on this last week for the Washington Post, and I think it's time that we really show them some major love, view them as this historic team, on pace to win more than 70 games, incredible offense, incredible defense, incredible chemistry, cohesion, locker room. They don't have the big-time second star. People will harp on that, but they have every other thing you could possibly need to be viewed as a title favorite. So I ask you, is Milwaukee clear-cut the best team in basketball right now? And do you think they're misunderstood? Do you think that the knocks about them wind up distorting maybe the casual fan or even the casual, you know, the diehard fan, the average diehard fan, their perception of this team.
Yeah, I've come around on the Bucks ever since they graced me with their presence in New York, and I was basically playing just for me, as you said.
Unbelievable. So you're a coward and you can be bought. Is that what we're learning today, Michael? Come on, man.
So, like, you know, heading into the season, I thought that, you know, I respected them. I respect Giannis, of course. And I thought that letting Malcolm Brogdon was basically going to haunt them come playoff time, which it still may that still may happen for sure. But, you know, I just think
it hasn't happened yet, though, right? Isn't that an important update on that point? Because I was with you on that, but don't we need to say, like, the facts are in to date and it hasn't been really meaningfully bad in any way?
No. Obviously, the playoffs are different than the regular season, but they are, when you go 39-6 and you have the best point differential by 5 points, you have the best defense by 3 points, you have the second best offense, you are playing faster than every other team, basically. Like, and you have Giannis, who is just this unguardable freak of nature who's decided now to shoot those straightaway three-pointers and hit them at a decent enough rate that'll make you stop and pause. Like, it is a very scary team. I thought that they were too top-heavy coming into the season. I like Chris Middleton. I didn't think he was a capable number two. And, you know, I wrote this piece recently for SB Nation about Milwaukee's bench, which is, like, by far the best bench in basketball. And when basically Mike Budenholzer has adopted a philosophy that the San Antonio Spurs had forever, which is basically, like, we have all these guys, we trust everyone on our roster, people will plug people into our system, and they'll get it done. Even when you know, Tim Duncan or Manu or Tony Parker are on the bench, like, the bench will carry us. And that's what's happened with Milwaukee. You have Kyle Korver, George Hill, Ersan Ilyasova. These guys are having tremendous seasons. They're all great shooters. You know, Robin Lopez has come in, and he's basically a carbon copy defensively of what his brother does. He's also shooting threes too. So they play these lineups that have, you know, all five guys are off the bench. Giannis and Chris Middleton are not playing on the court. They don't stagger. And these units are outscoring the opposition. And it's like no other team is able to do something like this. So it's just like, it's super impressive. It's very helpful for the regular season, obviously. But then you get to rest Giannis. You get to rest Middleton, who's averaging 28 minutes a game. Giannis is leading the team with 30.4 or something like that. Like, these are ridiculous numbers. So they're keeping care physically of their superstars. And that's going to help in the playoffs. And you know, they haven't even really had to tinker too much rotationally with playing Giannis at the five and stuff like that. But when they do, he's been super successful and everything's just kind of fit in great. They have enough shooting. They have enough defenders. A lot of these guys are two-way players. I think they are by far the championship favorite right now. It wouldn't, like, totally shock me if, you know, a team like the Lakers or a team like the Clippers beat them in the finals. But I would be shocked if this team did not reach that far.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that we should discuss their potential of winning the title more than we do, because I think there has been some hesitation on that front, including myself. I mean, I think, you know, Middleton needing to be that guy, it does wind up overwhelming a lot of these other factors where you're just saying, like, okay, if it's him versus Anthony Davis, how's that going to go for them? If it's him versus Paul George, how's that going to go for them? And they just have a different model, and their model really, really works. If you want to use the Spurs comparison, I mean, you know, who is the, they had a lot of stars, right? But did they have a second super duper star for their last titles when they were just really, really gunning in 2014? I mean, you know, Parker was injured in the playoffs. Ginobili could be a hit or miss guy. Kawhi wasn't really that offensive threat. You know, Duncan was the centerpiece of those teams, but it wasn't this, like, big two, big three model, which has been so in vogue lately. And I just think it's a reminder, you can win titles different ways. Same deal with the Dallas Mavericks, right? I mean, Dirk is a singular star. He gets great contributions from everybody around him. And that's how they wind up beating the big three Heat. I think those are instructive comparison points here, because Milwaukee went 60-22 last year. In the playoffs, they started 10-1 before the four-game losing streak against Toronto. As you've mentioned, this season, they're 39-6. If you add those numbers up, it's an insane winning percentage. And yet what we do tend to focus on is the four straight losses in the Eastern Conference Finals. And that's fair to a point, but it's also just like not very representative of who this organization is over the last 2 years if you're going to dwell on that 1 week, right? And so I just think, like, big picture, even though I consider myself like personal hype man for Giannis, I still think I'm drastically underrating these guys. They have a very, very good chance of winning the title this year. And that's shouldn't be a controversial or, you know, surprising thing to say, but I just feel like when I'm listening to other podcasts or listening to discourse around the league or just even talking to people, I just hear so much hesitation about this team, and I don't get it. Why are people afraid to say it? Why are people afraid to say, yeah, you know what? Milwaukee could definitely win the title this year, or I think Milwaukee is going to win the title this year, and I'm edging towards that direction.
I don't know what the hesitation is beyond the points that we mentioned, like Middleton not being an AD caliber or a Paul George caliber player. Like, Middleton's very good. Eric Bledsoe is someone who we just, I think, assume will stink it up in the playoffs, because that's what, like, kind of when you think about Eric Bledsoe, that's the performances that he has in the postseason. And he's kind of a bit of a question mark, but like, it's not like they're dependent on Eric Bledsoe to come through. They have all these pieces off the bench who have been really great. George Hill is probably going to be, he's not going to shoot, one would imagine, 50% for the rest of the season and into the playoffs, but like, he has severe gravity. Kyle Korver, the way that defenses, like, who Kyle Korver was also, you know, we should mention, not on the team last year. Kyle Korver, like, nobody has gravity like Kyle Korver. When he comes off those stagger screens in the corner, like, the defense just totally panics. And so when they play those lineups that they haven't really had to in the playoffs, with Giannis at the five, Middleton, Korver, Hill, Bledsoe, Wes Matthews, whoever that you want to put in that fifth spot, I don't know how you defend that. I really don't. And I think Giannis has elevated himself on the defensive end to be able to handle that role as that anchor. So it's just a really flexible team, a really dangerous team. They shoot threes better than anybody, in my opinion. And they should be the favorite. They should be.
Yeah, they're a squad. All right, let's talk about a team that's reeling a little bit. That would be the Houston Rockets. Now, they did get a win over Denver on Wednesday night, but prior to that, it had been, I think, what, four straight losses, including to the Lakers last Saturday, which I thought was, you know, fairly humbling and humiliating, with the crowd giving LeBron MVP chance, the Lakers fans there in Houston kind of overshadowing Harden and Westbrook. I'm curious, when you look at Houston, and I know they're your title pick, and I know you regret that a little bit, we don't need to harp on that part, but just like, as they go you. Into the... We've been down that road. I've tortured you enough for that one already. But when you look at this trade deadline, they have to make a deal, right? They have to go get reinforcements or they're dead in the water. That's the point that I've reached. And it's not just because of that Lakers game. It's just because of the vibe around the team. It's because of just kind of the top-heavy nature, where a lot of the role players are just not that actively involved. It's because they have the lowest scoring bench in the league. It's because they don't have really quality 3-4, you know, kind of combo forward defenders to handle the big time elite wing playmakers. I don't know, man. I just think that they have to go do something. This group right now is just not good enough. Are you with me?
I go back and forth, to be honest. I mean, it would be great, of course, if they added Andre Iguodala or they added Robert Covington. But like, when I look at their weaknesses and I look at the slide that they had, it feels to me like this is a team that does not care about the regular season. They are effort issues, and they don't get back in transition. They get gutted, and they have the worst transition defense in the league. They don't rebound with the energy and enthusiasm that you need to rebound the basketball. It's like, it's a mindset that can change with the group that's there. And when Harden...
So put a finer point on that.
Yeah.
Are they bought in? Are we sure they're bought in?
I mean, if you're like in the front office, you're you're telling yourself that this is a flip the switch team. That's what you're telling yourself.
You're deluding yourself, right?
I think if they do flip the switch, though, which I think is possible, I think that they can still be a super dangerous team. Like, look, you still have Harden. You have Westbrook, who is quietly playing great basketball throughout the team's struggle. And,
it's a great point. He hasn't been their problem, right? I think the problem has been more like Eric Gordon and the bench. I mean, the fit stuff I thought was definitely an issue earlier in the season, but we can't really blame Westbrook for the last 3 weeks.
No, and I mean, you know, arguably their best five-man unit, which is, in my opinion, Harden, Westbrook, Eric Gordon, PJ Tucker, and Clint Capella, you know, that group has been trash. Like, they've been outscored by 40 points per 100 possessions. So I feel like that will turn around. They have not been able to even play basically at all Tucker at the five with Gordon, Russ, and Harden on the court. Like, these are the lineups that they will play in the postseason, and I have faith that they will do better in a playoff series than they've performed throughout the regular season. The problem, real quick, is just like, if you want a lollygag through the Western Conference in the regular season because you aren't up for it and you're not up for that 82-game grind, like, you're going to get a bad seed. And, like, no matter how you're built for the playoffs, like, it's too tough to go through a gauntlet if you don't have home court advantage in the first round. So that's definitely a concern. They need that for sure if they want to actually get to the finals, which I think is like still a 1% or 2% possibility. But it's like, you got to flip the switch sooner than later. You can't, like, you just can't hold on and do what you've been doing, because when you get to the playoffs, like, let's say you face Denver or Utah in the first round, you can beat them, but then you have to play the Lakers in the second round. Like, that's just not what you want.
Yeah, I'm out on this flip the switch idea.
You're just out.
Primarily, here's why.
Okay.
You have to have a strategy, a scheme to stop playoff LeBron, right? And that's somebody they haven't really had to deal with up until this point. And if you want to just say the same thing about playoff Kawhi, same deal, right? You need to have at least two very good perimeter defenders to use on those guys. And then you also have to have somebody as a backline defender in that Draymond, or even like, you know, one of the centers that Golden State has kind of rotated through as that, you know, backside rim protector, taking LeBron away from the painted area, which, you know, he attacks pretty relentlessly in the playoffs. So first of all, when I look at Houston's roster, it's PJ Tucker and then a bunch of other guys from a defensive standpoint that can be kind of rough, right? So I think they actually have to play Capella a lot in that matchup, just because otherwise, like, where's your rim protection coming from? And LeBron's just going to be too much for you. And I think that PJ Tucker does a great job on LeBron and other big name players, but he's not going to stop him by himself, right? I mean, would you rather have Iguodala, KD, Klay Thompson, Sean Livingston with Draymond behind them, or PJ Tucker with Capella behind him, or PJ Tucker as the center? Like, that sounds very, very exposed to me. That sounds like it will just get diced up by either LeBron or Kawhi in the playoffs. So to me, it's at a crisis, right? And I think that Lakers game kind of just like laid it out there. Like, if he's able to do, you know, 30 and 10 assists, or I think it was like 33 and 11, something like that, just that easily without Anthony Davis, you are in big trouble, especially when he's doing that on your home floor. So I think it comes back to ownership. Like, Tillman Fertitta, you were banging your chest at the end of last season, you know, describing how you were going to win titles with Harden and have a big offseason and everything else. Like, yes, you're spending the money on Harden, you're spending the money on Westbrook, you did re-up Eric Gordon, but, you know, now you got different matchups. Now you've got different teams that you've got to be concerned about, and you need help, man. And if you're going to duck the luxury tax again, you know, if you're going to kind of cheap out on it in this supposed title window when Westbrook's, you know, health isn't going to be getting any better here going forward and Harden's not getting any younger, that's on you as ownership. So I personally challenge Tillman Fertitta to go out there and make a move and address some of these weaknesses that I'm describing.
I don't, but like, Ben, like, it's just like, it's so difficult. Like, if I'm looking at the roster, like, all the contracts, we do this whenever we talk about any team that's trying to make a move right now. I mean, first of all, basically everyone is a buyer right now in the NBA, which is problematic for the trade deadline. And then you look at the contracts that you would like to move, and they're either not big enough. It's either not enough salary or it's too much salary. So when I look at their cap sheet, it's like Clint Capella is making $14.9 million. I would move on from Clint Capella for the right type of piece for a lesser rim protector plus a perimeter defender who can maybe shoot and hit an open three. I don't know where that package is, if it exists. It probably doesn't, or the trade would have been made by now. Like PJ Tucker, he's making, that's a tradable contract, $8.3 million, but you need PJ Tucker in the playoffs, so you're not going to trade him. So it's really difficult for them to pull something off like you're talking about.
I hear you. It's a great point, and like they've kind of backed themselves into a corner because they've already traded picks in that Westbrook deal, which that is going to come back to bite them because that could be like sweeteners to bring in a different type of player. But I guess I'm going to use a gambling analogy just to go straight at Tillman Fertitta because that's his business. Look, you're basically at this point, you're down to your mortgage of your house, okay? You've already bet everything else that you have of worth. The only thing left you've got is your mortgage. And so you're either going to dig yourself out, have this dream, Friday night at the casino where you bet your mortgage, it pays off, you go home happy, and boy, it was really close, and you've got a story to tell all your drinking buddies for the next 30 years about how you nearly, lost your house gambling, but wound up paying off and, just escaped by the skin of your teeth. Or you're going home with your mortgage flat broke, and you've got to talk to your family about, why you're not going to have a good life for the next 10 years. Like, that's where they're at. Like, I'm serious, though, Michael. I mean, where is this team going, right? They never should have traded Chris Paul, for sure. I mean, we knew that from the start. The secondary role guys are giving them basically nothing. I don't trust any of their pieces. I don't think Harden necessarily trusts a lot of those pieces based on the kind of burden he's still putting onto his own shoulders. I don't think Westbrook's making a lot of those guys better. And they've got some real obvious roster holes. So whatever trade it has to be, whatever it costs here at the deadline on the luxury tax bill, they have to do it. And if it doesn't work, they blow it up in the summer. That's how I would be approaching the deadline. If he sits on his hands or if he makes small trades to duck the luxury tax, that's a tell, Michael. That's going to be another gambling metaphor.
But
that's a tell that they don't actually believe. It's the tell they don't actually believe they're title contenders. That's my take on the Houston Rockets.
Yeah, I hear you. I actually don't even know like how you blow it up. So I assume when you say blow it up, is that including moving on from Harden?
I mean, to me, it would be everybody but Harden. Like Harden and 14 new faces with name tags next year is the squad.
Yeah, that's rough. I mean, I don't even know how you move on from Westbrook's. Like, I'm a firm believer that there's no such thing as an untradeable contract, but that contract is pretty sour. Like, I don't know who would take that on, how you would even get off of it, because as you said, they don't have the picks.
Just remember, New York and Chicago are still in the league, okay? Like, there will be a way. You're going to have to really scrape. Like, there's no doubt. It would be difficult. It would be painful. But this is it's something of their own doing, right? I mean, it's not like we should pity them or feel sorry for them or talk about, how difficult this is. They backed themselves in this corner.
No, I agree. I mean, I still think that they have the pieces here to make a run. I'm a big fan of Eric Gordon still, and he's working himself back from surgery. And he's actually shot the three ball pretty well since his return. Had a big game against the Denver Nuggets. As I said, Russell Westbrook looks even more comfortable than ever before. He's only attempted one three-pointer in his last three games, that's exactly what you want to see. If you're a Rockets fan, you don't want this guy jacking him up from the outside and settling when teams double Harden. So, like, there is a notable evolution taking place, I feel like, just in how they're playing and how they're learning to play with Harden. And it might just be that, like, if Harden gets hot for a month stretch, like, they're unbeatable. I don't know. That's, like, what you need to tell yourself if you're...
Yeah, for sure. I mean, he can play better than he's played this last month. There's no doubt. I mean, I just look at it like, okay, I appreciate Westbrook's restraint for the first time in his life, but you need to be able to shoot three-pointers in the playoffs, right? Like, that's going to be an issue.
Yeah, that's fair.
And also, Gordon, he could definitely play better. I mean, I think this is, you know, he's near career lows, I think, in field goal percentage and three-point percentage and scoring. And I think a lot of that is just injury-related, of course. And the more time he gets, I mean, that was a nice performance from him against Denver. Hopefully he can kind of build on that and give them a little bit better balance. I mean, he's just absolutely crucial for what they do. But still, man, I don't know. I think just being around that team and their vibe, they seemed a little bit frustrated. They seemed like, I guess I question their buy-in just a little bit. You know, whether the team still believes in the vision or whether they're starting to think like there's teams out there that are just better than us and we're not going to be able to get to their level. That is just, you know, purely my personal opinion, observing them after what was a demoralizing loss to the Lakers. But look, they got to go through the Lakers. They got to go through the Clippers. They've got to go through the Jazz right now. And I would take any of those teams to beat them in a playoff series. And I might even take Denver at this point to beat them in a playoff series. And that's not something I would have said last year.
Yeah, I can't go with you there because on either – I'm skeptical that Utah can get it done just because of the, how they match up. And I just think they don't really have anyone who can defend Harden and Westbrook. And we saw, you know, the past couple of years when they faced off, Gobert has been pretty – ineffective defensively or relatively ineffective defensively in that particular matchup.
The good part is you don't have to defend Westbrook in the playoffs. He just defends himself. So you'll be fine there. You do have to focus a lot of attention on Harden, I think, if you're Utah. That's been the trouble spot for them.
Yeah. We'll move off of this. I just want to say that when the Rockets were in town in New York earlier this season, I was having a conversation with someone in their front office courtside before the game, and he told me, you know, I asked him how Russ was mixing in and what just the vibe was around the team and if he had any concerns. And he said the only concern that he has with this team is that they won't take the regular season seriously. And that is what we've seen over the past few weeks. So I still think that if they are able to get it together at the right time, this group is good enough to win a couple playoff series and then make it interesting.
I hear you. It all comes back to Harden being able to step up, get back on track, and sort of right the ship. I think that's where their stability has always come from, and he's been able to deliver that during a number of regular seasons, and this has been an uncharacteristically rough stretch for him, and it will get better. All right, Michael, we've come to the end of another episode of Open Floor. And guys, thanks so much for listening and tuning in. Please help us spread the word by going to Apple Podcasts, search for Open Floor. That's two words. When you find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy. You can also follow Michael on Instagram and Twitter at Michael V as in Victor Pina. He's had a number of very interesting stories here recently, including that Milwaukee Bucks bench story and a bunch of other stuff. So be sure to check all that stuff out over at SB Nation. I'm on Instagram at Ben.Golliver. I've basically turned my Instagram account into a Zion Williamson fan account. I'm also on Twitter at Ben Golliver. Don't forget, subscribe to my newsletter, the Washington Post free weekly newsletter. The link to that is on my Twitter page. Very easy to find it. All right, Michael, until next week when we will discuss all-star picks, the starters, the biggest debates from the listeners, the Open Floor Globe that emailed us at openfloormail@gmail.com. I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.